Hello and welcome to another CG Garage. This is episode number 70 featuring Jacqueline Cooper. Melissa is joining me on the podcast today. Hi, Melissa. We have a few things. We have a few things we're going to announce, right?
Yes, I'm excited.
Okay, but let's talk about Jacqueline for a little bit. I recorded this podcast actually back in January. It's been sitting in the archives for a while because I have been trying to find the right moment for her because she wants to announce something that she's been working on, which we mentioned on the podcast, but we sort of had to wait for the right timing. So it's out now, actually, as of kind of right today. We happen to be recording this intro on Earth Day, right?
Yeah.
April 22nd is Earth Day. So the podcast itself will be out in a few days after that. But it's about the monarch butterflies and how the monarch butterflies, their population has depleted greatly. And she's created this amazing VR piece that you can check out. So if you want to go check it out, go to monarchvr.org and check out what she's been doing. So we talk about it in the podcast, and now you can actually go and check it out yourself. It's really, really cool.
I'm going to take a look at that.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it works on cardboard. I'm not exactly sure more about the details, if it's available and other things, but really, really cool. I'm very excited about what she's doing. She's also a big nature lover, as well as her father, who we talk about. She grew up in Los Alamos, and her father is a nuclear physicist and took up photography and does incredible wildlife photography, which apparently he has not shared with anyone on the internet except for right now.
Oh, wow.
He is going to share a couple of his photographs that we'll put up on our site so we can check it out.
Of butterflies, I hope.
Not butterflies. Of some wildlife in Africa, which is incredible. So those of you who check out this website or check out the podcast by just subscribing, we love you. But go to the podcast page itself on labs.chaosgroup.com and check out some of the images we have on there, including some of the monarch stuff that she's done.
Wonderful.
Yep. And so who is Jacqueline Cooper besides creating this awesome VR stuff? She is a very talented VFX compositor and has been doing this for many years. And we talk about what it's like to be a compositor. And those of you who actually don't know much about compositing, we get into it to that level so you actually can know what compositing really is about, as well as her being a woman in VFX and what women in VFX, being a woman in VFX means and the implications of how it's like to, sort of climb the ranks in that field, which is somewhat of a challenge sometimes.
Girl power.
Girl power, that's right. besides that, Melissa and I, are very excited because this is actually our last day in the office because we are flying out.
Stuttgart.
We're going to Stuttgart. We're going to FMX. We're very excited about FMX this year. We got lots of stuff that we're doing. Melissa, why don't you share some of that stuff?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm very excited because it's the first time I get to go to FMX, although I've been involved in the conference over several years.
Yep.
So I'm looking forward to explore. But for our part, the Chaos Group are running V-Ray Days, which I know are very popular. Mm-hmm. So on the Wednesday, it's our gaming and animation day. So we've got some presentations by our friends at Black and Blur, and also our own internal Chaos Group CG team, who have made this amazing Bulgarian village VR project.
Yeah.
I'm excited to find out more
about.
It's
really cool. Yeah, the 3D team has been getting so involved and they've wanted to sort of create their own content that is, sort of a larger scale project. They've been so used to creating scene files that look great, but just to showcase certain things of V-Ray, they decided they wanted to do a long form project together, and they created this Bulgarian folklore.
Yes, I think they've merged several different kind of fairy tale like stories together.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to hear not only the technical side, but also the kind of story behind it. Yeah, it looks good.
Yeah.
And then on the Thursday, we've got our cinema day. We've got Mackie Vision in and Framestore. Framestore are doing a talk about the Spectre title sequence.
Oh, right. And they did that in V-Ray for Nuke, right?
They did, yeah. So that's really relevant as our 3.3 came out this
week. Yeah, a lot of people are kind of blown away by the 3.3 update. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited about that. So go check out V-Ray for Nuke 3.3.
Yes. And then we've also got our booth in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So we've got a whole load of presentations going on throughout the week.
Yep.
There, lots of product updates, find out about the latest features, and we've got Q&A mm-hmm. with some of our visiting presenters, friends, mm-hmm. and of course our own CG team there as well.
Yeah, yeah. I should also note that I will be doing a short presentation at V-Ray Days as well to talk about labs and seeing things that are going on and give people an idea of what we do. I will also be at the booth a couple of times too, just mostly for Q&A, so in case you have questions about stuff or you want to be involved in labs or find an opportunity to be involved in labs.
And you've got your big presentation as well.
Right, right. I'm going to be part of a panel for Digital Humans that I'm doing as well. It's being hosted by Mike Seymour. Some really great people are going to be involved in there. Several of them are on the Digital Human League, such as Christoph Harry from Pixar and Thabo from Disney Research, I forgot who's going to be there from a game company, from Epic. But anyway, great panel. Excited to be on that. So make sure to check out the Digital Human panel. And I think Kevin is also going to be talking.
Yes, he is.
And he's going to be doing stuff on virtual production, which is really cool. So he's going to be part of another series of presentations on virtual production. So go check out Kevin Margo's talk over there as
Lots
well.
Lots going on.
Yeah, yeah. My calendar
it's gonna
is
be a busy week.
Full. All right, guys.
There'll be some drinking in between.
I'm sure. Hopefully enough to keep me going.
Some
from
Steins.
Yep, lots of beers and schnitzel. I'm excited. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So let's talk a little bit about the fact that I guess the first time that you and I worked together was on Tron, right?
I believe so. I was in Digital Domains commercial department, and then
were in commercials?
I was in commercials for a number of years before I moved into film.
All right. And so were you part of that group of people that was in commercials that kind of came with the Eric Barpa group along there, or...?
Around that time, I started on Percy Jackson first, uh-huh. and that was my first feature, Digital Domain, and it was a massive learning experience.
For yeah, me. But you've been doing this for a long time, though.
I have. I've been doing it for 14 years.
Okay, because I saw you'd started like way back, like almost 1996 on a few things, like as a technical assistant and stuff, right?
Yeah, in high school I used to work at a public access channel, actually, for my hometown.
Where's your hometown?
My hometown is Los Alamos, New Mexico.
You know, there's another Los Alamos person that was on this podcast.
Oh, really?
Yes, Steve Prieg.
That's right, yes, I know. He's a few years older than me, so yeah. I never knew him, but I've met him since, and we've talked about Los Alamos
yeah,
before.
Yeah, my dad actually lives in Albuquerque.
I heard that before, yeah.
Yeah, so he lives there, and he's been there for a while now. But I love New Mexico. Yeah, yeah. So you lived there, you grew up there?
Yeah, I grew up in Los Alamos.
So let me ask you this. So as people who grew up in Los Alamos, usually there's a very interesting reason why they live there.
Yes. yeah, my father is a nuclear physicist. He's retired now.
Yeah, that's usually the reason why people live there.
Absolutely. And
there's more PhDs per capita in Los Alamos than any other place in the planet, I think.
Yeah, it's incredible being raised in a scientific community, especially as an artist in mm-hmm. a scientific community. I found that incredibly challenging.
And were you always kind of felt to be an artist? I mean, I can see that from everything I know about you, that you've always been sort of very artistically driven, right?
I was, but I was a little bit confused, especially my father really wanted me to become a physicist.
And really?
It took a long time for him to realize that that wasn't my path.
Okay. So does he train you, try to teach you stuff about physics all the time? Do you hang out in the lab?
Well, we had this sort of interaction with each other because he wanted me to pass the AP Physics B exam. And every single day I would come home from school and he would sit down with me. And sometimes we'd work till 11 o'clock at night on physics,
really?
Trying to get the physics problems right. And I wanted him to just tell me what the answers were. Yeah. And he refused to tell me what the answers were because he told me it was the process that was the important thing.
Right. And all you wanted to do was just pass the class to appease your dad.
Exactly. So I didn't give a care, but he was determined to teach me and I was determined not to learn. And eventually I passed it with a 3 out of 5.
That's
and
pretty good.
I passed it. So that was good. But I think he realized at that point that he needed to let go.
But did he also know about your art background?
Well, he knew that I was interested in film and I was filming all the county council meetings and the school board meetings back then and doing a lot of editing of shows and being a technical assistant. So once that started becoming my main love, he backed off and...
Okay. Yeah. Well, you can have a future. You know, it's interesting because I know a lot of people who have a hard time with their offspring being wanting to be artists, right? They're always worried about being the starving artist is such a common term that's like, oh, you're gonna be an artist, you're gonna suffer and not be able to make money and do this and that. And that's not always the case, especially in Los Angeles. There's a lot of artists here that are very successful, right? Or people in an artist background.
Yeah, my father believes in the fact that you can't make money doing art, or at least he used to when I was growing up, and he was very against it.
Right. Yeah, and it's just hard for that mindset to understand that process, really. And, you know, a lot of people, my wife and I are both artists and we're very successful and we do very well for ourselves. But I think that's because we found a balance between doing art and problem solving at the same time and sort of working those things out. And so I think that's really, and the other thing, okay, here's another example, right? So I've recently become sort of friends with Norman Seif, who's one of the photographer guys I spoke about, and he did a podcast with him recently, and he's photographed hundreds and hundreds of famous artists. Like every rock album you've ever seen in the 70s is probably photographed by him, right? Mm-hmm. And he talks to a lot of artists and does interviews while he's talking to them, and that's how he gets these incredible emotional photographs from them. But he talks about creativity. That's his passion. And I love it. And I'm talk about it with him all the time. But he talks about it in the context that there's creativity everywhere. And he did an interview with the guys, the scientists at JPL who put the rover on Mars, right?
Yes.
And that, what he did, which was different than everyone else did, instead of saying, well, how did you put the rover on Mars, and they just tell you the solution, like, you know, like you're looking for. he talks to them as like, how hard was it to figure out that solution? And what he found in that process was that their way that they found solutions was exactly the way that everyone comes up with a creative process.
Yes.
You know, I'm sure your dad may realize that everything he does when he's solving problems is a creative idea, right? You have to let your brain go, aha. And that aha moment when your brain is able to put things together is the same thing that an artist goes through in a lot of ways, you know? And so I think that's something we strive for. We strive for that moment, you know, where we get something really cool that way.
Yeah. And one thing that's really interesting actually about my father is in retirement, I think he's become one of the best wildlife amateur photographers that I've ever seen in the world.
Really?
His photography is incredible and no one's seen it. And I just really want to grab it from him and start showing it at museums. It's really incredible.
Where do he do his photography?
Well, now he's traveling all over the world. So he's catching lots of different animals that are, you know, on the verge of extinction, and penguins and polar bears and grizzlies. And he really likes action shots. Uh-huh. So he'll have pictures of grizzly bears with fish in their mouth and, you know, this sort of thing. And they're incredible.
On a personal level, I would love to see those. And I'll tell you why specifically. My son, who's 6 years old, is obsessed with animals. Obsessed with them. And so whenever my wife goes on hikes all the time, and so the second he hears the door unlocking when she comes home, he's like, what animals did you see today? What did you see? And I was like, I saw 3 lizards and this, you know, like whatever it is. He's just obsessed about it. And he's recently become really, really obsessed about, and it's actually, he woke him up in a nightmare about the extinction problems.
Yeah.
And we went out on a hike the other day, and I was really kind of, I don't know why I told him this, because it was really kind of a bad thing, but I think I did. I just felt like I needed to tell him about the white rhinos and the fact that there's only three of them left in the world, and they're that's the last of them. They're never going to breed again. And he started crying and said, I don't want to talk about this anymore. And then he woke up in a nightmare about these rhinos. And he's just like, just completely devastated about this stuff. So I have a feeling that somewhere along the lines that that's going to be one of his things. So he's obsessed with animals and obsessed about that stuff. So I'm sure like any photographs that your dad has, I'd love to share them with him because he'd be really, really interested in seeing that.
Absolutely. Well, my dad has quite thousands and thousands, and he's starting to pick them out and show him at like local Los Alamos art shows and like that. But he's got so many endangered species and creatures I've never seen before. It's really impressive.
Yeah.
So, and he really, the interesting thing is, as an artist, I want to take his stuff and color correct it and all this stuff. And he says, no, I want to make it look as realistic as possible, as if you were standing out there for real in the wild.
Right.
And
right.
So he actually doesn't want me to
touch up
yeah, to touch up his photos very much,
right?
Which I actually find to be a bit interesting. And
it's interesting. Yeah. So what does he do with them? He just archives them and then puts them away, or
yeah, he
does
shows
he print
them,
them?
In, like, yeah, he prints some of them, and he, like, some of them are showing in the White Rock Library, which is near Los Alamos. Uh-huh. Like, so, you know, he puts them up and he gives them to people, and but he doesn't really do the online thing at the moment.
Right.
So I really want to, you know, I thought since he doesn't like putting his pictures online, that maybe I would try and find him a gallery, because his work is incredible.
Yeah. Well, isn't that cool that now all of a sudden you have something to share with him a little bit differently? How did that all start? Did that feel pretty cool that you find this bonding moment with your dad in a way?
Yeah, it was cool. Although there was an interesting moment that happened where me and my father went to Hawaii uh-huh. together, and we both had the same camera.
Uh-huh.
I think it was a 7D maybe. And we were both taking pictures, and we had the exact same lenses. And my father decided that he liked the photographs that I was taking more than he liked his own. And he's uh-huh. a very competitive man, actually.
Right.
And so he went out during the last 3 days of the trip and did nothing but take photographs while I was on the beach, like, sipping, you know, margaritas.
Trying to beat your photographs?
Yeah, trying to beat my photographs. And then
okay.
And then there's this
competitive photography.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. As the sun was setting, there's like this thing called a green flash that you
yeah,
can see.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And he got a picture of this. He was so obsessed.
Did he really
he got
get
a,
it?
He got an actual picture
I've never
of this.
Seen it.
It's incredible.
To me, it's a myth.
Yeah, no, he caught it on camera, and he couldn't wait to show me all the great pictures he'd taken. And then he immediately went home and upgraded all of his lenses, and
wow.
And that was the start of his getting back into photography.
Well, that's really cool. When was this?
Let's see, that would have been around 2007 or so.
Okay. Wow. That's really amazing. So but obviously you've been doing photography as well, right? So you've been involved yeah. behind the lens, you know what it's like. How did that help influence what you do professionally? Obviously, I've known you as a compositor for a long time. Is that still what you consider yourself at this point?
It is, although some interesting things people might not know about me.
Yeah.
One of them is that I was a VJ for a little while.
Really?
Yeah, for a group called DMT, which is Department of Mental Technology. And uh-huh. it's a,
actually, I don't see that. That seems very normal to me from knowing you.
Yeah, I know. Not that surprising, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
But they actually went to Burning Man and did a lot of festivals. And,
yeah.
And I got to do some of the artwork and put it up on the big screen.
You've been a big Burning Man person, right?
Yeah, I've been doing it since 2004, so
right.
I've been going for a long time. But to see my work up on the Esplanade, like massive screen,
right.
is one of the highlighting moments for me of my life. And so that was one thing that I was interested in for a long time. And and then last year I had the opportunity to do a show in Hollywood where me and my husband used Touch Designer and did a big Hollywood show.
Okay.
And so we're kind of getting back into live projection and live interactive projection.
Okay.
And and also I'm getting into other immersive experience such as virtual reality, and
right.
I'm really wanting to do more social impact pieces. So this is about this piece. I'm trying to raise money for the monarch butterfly whose habitat is endangered right now,
right?
Because they're spraying Roundup on all of the milkweed.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to raise awareness, and I actually filmed and directed a PSA, which I'm working on, and
really?
I have a virtual reality piece, which I can show you later, and I'm going to make an app of it. I'm hoping people will buy it to show their kids, and
right.
and that the money will go directly to a foundation.
Yeah.
And so I just think that the medium that we have is so powerful. In fact, I would arguably say one of the most powerful mediums in the world for affecting people. And I really want to see us start using it for the power of unity and the power of, you know, that it has over people, and start really utilizing that and collaborating on that.
Yeah. I think the monarch butterfly, to be honest, is one of the most bizarre and fascinating things in nature. This is a butterfly. I'm just going to the outline, and you can correct, you know this, but I'm just going to put it out there for the audience. Like, this is a insect, right, with a teeny, teeny, teeny little brain, right, that has evolved to the point where it can do this incredible migration, right? And it does a migration over four generations, I believe.
Yeah.
Right? Which is also amazing. So it starts off in a very specific forest in Mexico, right?
Yes.
And it moves and it spreads itself out across the United States up to Canada. And it moves there from in spring, I guess. It starts in the spring. And it moves itself up all the way to Canada through that migration process and spreads itself out. And it takes three generations of butterflies for it to actually reach Canada, right?
Yeah.
And then once it gets to Canada, then it starts to migrate back. And the fourth generation butterfly, I guess it's got to be a special butterfly, right? Because a fourth generation butterfly does the entire trip in one generation, all the way back to Mexico, and therefore nests, and that's the one that starts the new migration again, right?
Yeah.
That is incredible. Like, how does this entity work and understand that and created this and passed that instinct of navigation through this whole process? I don't know. It just seems it's not a learned thing. It can't be a learned thing, right? I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely mind-boggling to me. And I've actually been driving up the PCH and seen them in the middle of the migration, mm-hmm. right above the PCH, and you just look up and you see swarms of butterflies flying. It's really incredible.
Right. And the problem with the fact that the population is massively depleted, right?
Yeah.
So it's gone from what I saw from your Facebook post, you said it was 1 billion down to 58 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, basically we're talking 5% of what it used to be, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So much, very depleted. Now, what's the cause of the depletion of these butterflies?
So it turns out that when they spray Roundup on all of the milkweeds to destroy the milkweed, it's not only hurting the butterflies, actually, it's hurting the bees and all.
Right.
And butterflies are also a pollinator. And so
right.
it's basically killing them and it's destroying their habitat.
Right.
And yeah, it's really tragic, and it's something that I feel passionately about for a few reasons, but one of them is that it's not, you know, in Alaska, it's not in, you know, Africa. It's something that's in our backyard. It's something
right.
that's really close to us. In fact, I'm going to be taking a virtual reality camera in 3 weeks to actually film them in Pismo Beach, which is one of the places that they rest at.
Right.
And it's just something that's so close to us that I feel like we have a responsibility as locals to try and protect their habitat.
Yeah. Yeah. Ironically, I was at Pismo Beach not long ago. I don't know why. That's a great story. And how are you going to film them? What are you going to do with your virtual? What kind of virtual reality camera are you going to use? Are you just do a 360 video? How is that going to be?
Well, I haven't actually, this one is basically 10 GoPros slung together, so I haven't actually used the specific camera before.
Okay.
It'll be sort of my first time with it, but so I'm not sure. Supposedly after 8, you can start getting some, you know, true stereo in there. I don't know whether it'll end up just being 360 or not.
Okay.
I guess that'll depend on, you know, how close the cameras are to each other and whether they overlap.
What are you trying to, what's the story you're trying to tell? Because this is, I do some virtual reality stuff and are in a lab stuff, and we've got a bunch of people talking about how to use virtual reality in an interesting way.
Yeah.
And I can show you some examples we've done, I think, that are pretty cool. They're not as, what you're doing sounds very important, but I'm trying to find out, like, how is virtual reality going to be an advantage in this situation for you? What do you feel that virtual reality is going to offer people for this specific cause that's going to make it more interesting for them to see?
Well, a term that's been going around a lot in VR circles is a big empathy box. And when you are putting your 3D goggles on and you're looking around, mm-hmm. and you're seeing how beautiful it is to be surrounded by butterflies,
mm-hmm.
then you can't help but feel more empathy for them than you would if you just saw a passing commercial. I think it has this ability to touch you on an entirely new level.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm hoping is that will spur people into action in ways that, you know, maybe they wouldn't have before.
Right. I think you're right about that. I think the empathy box is very interesting. I think Chris Milk talked about the empathy box, which is specifically why he did that video about the refugee in Pakistan, right?
Yeah, I believe so. Or Syria, maybe?
Yeah, but it was about this young girl, and you basically, it's hard to look away because you're there, right? So you're forced to be in a situation. So I've had this conversation with a good friend of mine as well, who's been doing some VR projects, which is Kevin Mack. Do you know who Kevin Mack is?
I do. I actually I've been trying to schedule a meeting with him just to shake his hand. And
I can get you in touch with Kevin. He's awesome.
Super awesome. He talked at Noman a number of years ago and had all of those beautiful Houdini statues that he'd made. And those are incredible pieces.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see. Is it ShapeSpace that he's creating?
Yeah, ShapeSpace. I can actually show it to you. So.
Yeah, I really am excited to check it out.
I will show that to you. I think you will just be blown away by that. But the thing that he talks about specifically, which I think is fascinating in terms of the VR world, is the fact that he feels that there is a gap between what people are actually doing in VR and what actually VR is about, right? Because there's basically they're all excited about the technology of VR, but they don't really know how to use it correctly. You know what I mean? Because they're basically, what they're doing is they're recreating what they're already familiar with, which is, you know, filmmaking, right?
Yes.
But filmmaking is a third-person experience.
Yes.
Right? Filmmaking is you're sitting behind, you're looking through a window, and you're being told a story, and it's like reading a book, right? But it's in a visual form. And you know that. You're a VJ, right? So you're basically giving someone an expression that they can experience, which, by the way, third-person experience doesn't make it it makes it passive by definition, but does not make it not engaging. You are very much engaged as a third person, but a first-person experience, which is the nature of what VR is, forces you to be a participant in this experience,
yes.
Right? And I think that that's the gap that he's trying to fill, right? He's trying to understand the definition of that, and he's talking to me about that, which I think is really interesting, because if you're surrounded by butterflies, it's a really cool thing. Actually, I'll tell you an interesting thing I saw. It was at SIGGRAPH, I don't know, years and years ago, right? But what was really cool about it, it was a projection on the wall that had video that was playing, but the video was real time, right? But the video was all silhouette, basically black and white, so it looked like shadow puppets, right?
Oh wow!
But then you, as a user, could shadow the projection and be involved in the projection.
Yes.
Okay. Now they would have butterflies as a projection that looked like a shadow of a butterfly. And there was a camera that would see your shadow and interact with your shadow and the butterfly shadow. So you would see yourself and you would see your shadow and you would move back and forth and the butterflies would react towards your hand as they're moving. And then when you'd stop, the butterflies would actually land on your hand in shadow form. But your brain could actually feel the butterflies landing because of the way your brain worked, which was fascinating to me to see that. And I think that's the idea of like finding a way to make your brain think that you're there, right? And I think that's what VR is able to do, right?
Absolutely. I think that's its power. And if you have all of this power, what are you going to do with it? And when I answered that question for myself anyway, I said, I want to make the world a better place because I'm a hippie.
Yeah. I think that's a good thing. Is if we're finding a good way to use technology to get people excited about something, I think it's really cool. Let's find a way to get people excited about it. If you find a way, it's like, and get involved, you know, in some way, you know?
Yeah, well, that's my hope. And I think the more that we can collaborate and work together, I think there's a lot more possible. I think that we're just scraping the surface of this new medium and just, I think, you know, it's the right time to be a visionary.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, what we do in labs, obviously, is we do a lot of projects where we get involved with people, et cetera. So I'd love to see more about it. Maybe there's a way that we can be able to help you in terms of something you're trying to do as well. Always a good incentive to do that stuff. And especially if it's for the cause that I think we want to do, we would love to figure out to help you out if we can. So we'll figure something out. We'll see what we can do. And, you know, at the very least, I want to know more about how it goes and help your campaign. So
yeah, absolutely. And I probably will have some more news in a number of months. So we'll have to check back with each other.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great. That sounds great. But I want to go, you know, because there's a lot of people that want to learn about CGN, and I always go off the rails a little bit. But let's talk a little about compositing, because the fact is we don't talk about compositing that much on this podcast, and I think it's an important subject. So I'm going to go back to that technical stuff a little bit. How would you describe we have people that listen to this podcast that are not even that know CG only from a very specific field, like let's say architecture, et cetera. They may not actually have a understanding of what a compositor does. What would you describe a compositor doing?
Well, I normally explain it to people as putting together layers in order to make something look better than it did before.
Okay.
And so that would include, you know, maybe a matte painting or maybe taking a green screen, something that didn't exist before, and sticking a person in an environment that doesn't actually exist.
Right.
And then maybe you're throwing shadows and, you know, smoke and, you know, maybe a CG dragon flies by and just stuff that doesn't actually exist. And you're sticking all together and making it feel perfect.
Right.
And we're the last people that it touches before it goes to sound design and then off to, you know,
That's a good point, because I want to make sure that people know that when people they talk about rendering stuff, for example, we, you know, obviously people that use V-Ray, they render material, right? But that's in the visual effects world, that's not the last stop, right? A lighter is the bridge between the 3D world and the 2D world, right? Take the 3D and make it a 2D. Once it's 2D, it's not done. It goes to a compositor that makes it perfect, right?
Yes.
So you and I, as professionally, when I was a lighter and you were a compositor, we would talk to each other very, very closely about all the stuff that you needed to make sure that it would look perfect, right?
Absolutely.
So that's that bridge that happened. So you, as a compositor, have to know a little bit about everything that happened before.
Yes.
So you probably know a lot about what's coming out of lighting, because you know about, you know, oh, I need some spec here. I need this. I need more alpha. I need a mat for this. I need this. I need all this stuff. So you communicate with your lighters on that level. But you also have an idea of like something's not right here. Something's wrong with the animation, something's wrong with this. And there's a sort of a communication. So as someone who is a lighter, I communicate with compositors very intimately all the time, because it's like I'm delivering it to you guys, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what is a skill set do you think that is the most important in the compositor out there? What do you say is like, you know, that person's a good compositor because they what?
Well, I'm going to go so far as to say have a vision for the shot.
Vision? Okay.
I think when you look at it, you have to decide where you want to go with it. Is it too bright? Is it too dark? Do you want to make it feel soft? Do you want to make it feel dark and mysterious? Like, what are you going for? Because all of that is possible, you know, based on the colors that you choose to correct it. And,
right.
you know, the way, you know, you can drastically change the way a shot feels based on just certain choices, thousands of choices that you make every moment.
Right.
And so I think the first thing is to try and figure out where you're headed with the shot. And then say, you know, I think I'm going to make this one kind of darker and, you know, maybe a little bluer and maybe mm-hmm. just make it feel a little more depressing because I'm, you know, working on a very moody, yeah. you know, sad moment in the film.
And then you have to also worry about continuity and all those other exactly. things. Right. So, but you have to have a vision, right? So that means you have to, the compositor probably has the best eye of all of the visual effects world in that sense that they know how it's supposed to look correct, right? You, a lighter can actually get away with a lot, okay? Especially now where, you know, when I first started, we were delivering 8-bit images that were like, sorry, here you go. Do your best, right? Now we deliver like EXRs that have got all the layers embedded and stuff. So it's like, yeah, the compositor will figure it out, right? But the compositor basically has to figure it out. So the compositor has to know what something's supposed to look like and have a really, really, really good eye. And here's where I'm going with this, because it's, I know it's a little, it's a completely loaded question on this, all right? I believe that the reason, if you go to a visual effects company, go to a large visual effects company, where if all the departments, if you take all the things, you know, lighters and animators, et cetera, where is the highest concentration of women artists?
Well, I would say compositing.
Yes. And, and the reason I feel that's true is that I believe that women are way have there's a something, you know, in women that allow that eyes can see color and distinction in color way better than men can, right? They can see differences in color. They can see and understand that stuff. And I think that's a skill set. And I know it's, you know, it's a little bit sexist to put it that way, but there's a reason why there's more women in compositing in any other field. Now, I'm not going to say that there's more women compositor than men, because that's definitely not the case.
No, it's still dominantly men.
Dominantly men, but if there's a place where women are more like fit in better, and it's because I think that there's that skill set, and I know that it's like most of the really good eyes that I've seen, the ones that can really see differences in color, that's actually come from a lot of women. I know that's weird to say that, but I think that's really the case. Do you feel that do you feel that's true as well? Or,
well, most of the women compositors I know have an amazing eye.
Right.
So I will at least go that far to say that I do think that there is something about that, that we're just something about our physiology or something is trained yeah. to see color in a certain way. And, you know, a lot of the women I've worked with have been, you know, incredible compositors.
Yeah, absolutely. And here's the thing. I think that they're really good compositors. I've actually known men compositors who I figured out somehow they never admitted it were colorblind, right?
Yes.
Because that's colorblindness is way more common in men than women as well, right? Because yeah. there's that's another thing. But it was really, really interesting to like, to notice that. So I think that women are really, really good at understanding the best quality picture that comes out of an image. And here's the problem I have. Like I said, it's a loaded question. I went to the Bake Offs recently.
Okay, I just missed it. I'm sorry.
All right, so I went to the Bake Offs recently. I was actually last weekend, which will, when this podcast come out, it'll make people realize how old this podcast is. But that's fine. but I went to there, and we were discussing it in a group I talked to, and they basically said, how many people presented at the Bake Offs that were not white men? And the answer was zero, right?
Are you serious? Yeah. I didn't realize it was that dominant.
Yeah, it's all white men. And actually, if you had an English accent, you were also in an advantage in that group.
Always.
Always, right? But it was mostly white men, and there's pretty much zero women that presented, which sounds, it's not surprising, obviously. But considering the fact that I think that women have a better eye, and here's the thing, the role of the visual effects supervisor, you're the compositor, right? You still have to present it to visual effects supervisor, and that person has to give the final okay on stuff, right?
Yes.
But I think that there should be more women visual effects supervisors out there, because I think that they have the better eye in a lot of cases in terms of making sure quality control is out there. And not to say that men shouldn't be involved in that process, but the role of the visual effects supervisor is to deliver the vision, the best quality vision that the director wanted to be out there, right? And I think there's a relationship that happens between directors and visual effects supervisors that they can communicate well, and I think that's an important part of it. But I think in terms of QC and beauty and everything else, I think that women should be more involved in visual effects, don't you think?
I absolutely agree, and I can't figure out whether there's some sort of glass ceiling or whether it's just... I mean, because I know some really amazing compositors that right. would deserve that spot.
Yeah, and I think my goal on this podcast has been recently, because I was like, I realized like someone, well, Gina, who I work with, and she's great, and she said, "Why you don't have many women on your podcast?" I was like, "Shit, I don't." And that's the problem, is like it's actually hard to find women on the podcast. So I'm like, all right, I want to understand what it is and what's going on. So I want to get people like you, Kim Olson's another person I would love to get on here. She'd be hilarious on this podcast.
She's a funny person.
Yeah. So, but those are the type, I want to understand what it can happen in the industry to be able to make sure that women are more celebrated in this field. And this is not the only one, by the way. We also have a huge group of people that we work with that are ArcViz. ArcViz is actually probably one of our big clients at Chaos Group. And so ArcViz is arguably 20 to 40 times larger than visual effects, okay? It's a huge field. Lots of individuals, right? It's not necessarily, it's small groups. So it's not like peer pressure glass ceiling stuff. It's like individual people, right? I think it's 93% men.
Wow. Yeah. The tech field.
It's a tech field, right? Do you think women are intimidated by technology? Do you think women are told not to approach technology? Do you think that happens at that point?
I do think that there's an issue with maybe socialization during a certain period where women maybe don't feel like they could be as tech savvy.
Right.
And I also think I'm going to go out on a limb here because I don't really know, but I think women do better with collaboration. And I feel like one thing I actually thought about a book that I would love to write one day. I don't think I ever will, but it called like The Zen of Visual Effects, talking about collaboration as opposed to competition in the visual effects field, and how when the times that we do collaborate with each other,
right.
how it's quantifiable, probably how much more we can accomplish, how much better we do, how much better the work looks. But right. yet a lot of companies actually try and foster a competitive versus a collaborative edge at the workplace. And I actually think it's a hindrance in many, many ways.
Okay. Let's talk about another part of the visual effects field where women are very dominant, right?
Yeah.
Which is production side. Right. Yeah. If you look at the visual effects companies out there, where there's actually probably almost more women than men is usually coordinators, project managers, and producers. Right. Yeah. Mostly women.
Yeah.
Because they know how to get people to work together. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. That's what I mean. They're good at collaboration. They're good at organization. There's right. certain skill sets that naturally lend themselves to women, and so I can see why they would be great. Yeah, production managers.
Very, very typical. Inner office romance is between a male artist and a female coordinator.
Yes.
right? Because that's really, they interact constantly with each other, and that's how they basically get to know each other in some ways. And that person is like, did you get this done? Did you get this done? Did you get this done? Like, no, leave me alone. I'm trying to make my shot. It's like, you know, so that interaction happens all the time. And you know, women tend to keep guys on track, right? Which actually, I think actually says a lot to do with why compositors are also, you know, happen to have women, because they're like, did I get my stuff? Did I get this? Did I get that? And you basically have to coordinate with all these people, right? You're not like a lone gunman in a lot of ways. So I think that there's a way that needs to happen, that we can find, we can celebrate women in this area. And here's the thing, right? Hold on, I'm going to take my hat off because it's a little hot. here's, I think that there's a way that we can find, women in art have long been celebrated, right?
Yeah.
Women artists are well known at this point. Everyone loves them. But somehow when the technology gets involved, it becomes a barrier somehow. I don't know. There's something strange about what it is. Do you think it's just a boys club? I mean, you worked at DD. It's kind of a frat house, right?
It is. It is a boys club.
Right. Do you think that's the threat there for the artist? Because I don't, it's not, have you ever felt that men were like, well, she's a girl? No, they're not really. Not from my perspective.
No, I didn't really feel it like that. Although I did notice like certain people would take, like senior artists would take people under their wing and train them up a little bit, like, you know, more mid-level or junior people. And that tended to be men helping men out, interestingly. So it would be interesting to see if more senior artists.
So you think mentorship was much more men to men because they felt more comfortable with that than doing men to women?
Potentially. I mean, and that's just been my personal experience. I'm not saying I've had some wonderful men who have mentored me as well.
Absolutely.
So I don't wanna...
No. I'm trying to understand the trend, because I'm trying to find a way. It's like, what is it that causes men? Why is it that we're not seeing more women visual effects supervisors? Because to me, it makes sense that there would be more of that. There'd be more women in power, more women be able to drive, more women be able to speak about the visual effects out there, right? And I think that's rare.
Another thought that I had about this actually has to do with the power of negotiation. And they've actually proven, and well, statistically, women are likely to have 20% less income than men for doing the exact same job.
Right.
And so that's just sort of a figure out there. And I think potentially in visual effects, sometimes that can actually be even greater. And I think potentially if women aren't as good at negotiating jobs and negotiating their role in those jobs, that... potentially, if they're not standing up for themselves and saying, hey, I'm good enough to be a visual effects supervisor, give me the job.
Sure.
That maybe that could also be part of the glass ceiling.
Yeah. I think women negotiate themselves to the point that they feel comfortable.
Exactly.
And men are like, they see themselves greater than they actually are in a lot of ways. And somehow they can convince people that, and they're like, sure, we'll give you more money. And so that happens. So there they are, right? And I think that it's harder. It's wrong, but I think, yeah, I don't want to say that it's women's fault that they don't advance, because that's wrong thing to do. I think that there should be a way to incentivize people to realize that women need to be able to see more. I'd love to see more more women presenting at the bake-offs. I'd love to be able to see more women put in positions of power. I think it's great that there's a role for that basically puts women in a very strong. Let me just put it this way, right? You've worked at DD. Lisa Baru is like one of my favorite people in the world.
She's amazing. I love her.
Okay, so she is a powerful woman in that company, even though she'll never admit that, because she's just like, oh, whatever, I'm just Lisa. But she has a way of getting the best out of people.
Yeah.
Even as a producer, well, she will just make you want to fight for her, right? She'll make you want to do things. And I think she's really incredible at doing that. But she also makes you feel very comfortable so that you want to give your best out there. And that, she does it in a way that I don't think, that I think is unique to the way women treat people.
She nurtures.
She nurtures, right?
Do you remember on Tron how she brought all that food in so that people could at least be eating healthy even though we were working incredibly long hours? I mean, I will be forever grateful to her for doing that.
Yeah.
You know?
We were working crazy hours. And I'm just going to tell people a little bit about... She had a background where she had worked as... a line producer, right? I think she worked as a line producer on big feature films. And what a line producer does is the person that is making sure that whatever happens on set is all set up, right? So they make sure that everything's set up for the day. You got everything you need. You have all your crews lined up and et cetera. A producer is a little bit more overall than that, but a line producer actually works on it. So involved in catering, craft services, making sure all your grips are there, everything you need to do that. So she had that background, and when we were really working, and we had a lot of people, there was one of the probably may still be at this point probably the biggest show that DD had ever done. Right?
Ever done, yeah. I agree.
So Tron was huge, and we were working crazy hours, and she knew that we were okay with our budget, that we could make sure that the crew was going to be well taken care of, and hired. Unbelievable catering.
Yeah.
Really good catering. So we would have some of the best food out there that was serving not like a small group. We were serving hundreds of people. I remember one point we got full Thanksgiving dinners.
Yeah.
With like turkeys were arriving. Unbelievable food, top-notch, incredible stuff. That was not the only thing. She also provided two masseuses and a chiropractor.
Oh, some of those massages were lifesavers.
You would basically, you could sign up for, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I can sign up for a 20-minute massage during the day and I can take a break and get a massage on because you were going to work on a Saturday anyway, right? So
So
you say, I'm going to get a massage, or it's like my neck's not feeling right. I have a meeting with a chiropractor and the chiropractor would help you out. And it was all taken care of. And it was amazing that she makes sure that and it was a really great experience. And she did that, you know, I was like, yep, I'm taking care of my guys, you know, everyone's happy. I want to make sure that everyone knows that. And so when that ended, it was like, it was a celebration, really, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And she did it, and we still made a bunch of money on that movie, right? So it's not like she had to sacrifice that much. She knew that I could still make that happen based on my budget because I balanced everything, that I knew the size of the crew we had, et cetera. So she's really good at this. I'm actually going to try to get Lisa on this podcast because I want to know, like, I want people to know the art of production, right?
Exactly. And I think that what you brought up, bringing it back around to what I was saying earlier, the fact that she looked after people, the fact that she made sure that everyone was okay, we still got, and in fact, I would argue that we got more done.
Absolutely.
I mean, I can't remember if we had 1,000 shots or something crazy and a reasonable, I mean, we had a lot of people, but a reasonably small team, and we were able to whip all of those shots out because she looked after us and because, you know, there was a sense of collaboration on that project.
Yeah.
And I actually think that it's a quantifiable thing to say, if you look after your people, mm-hmm. and make sure that they're happy, then you can get more done and make more money. And I actually think that, you know, this is an important thing because not every shop runs the ship that way.
No. And she's proven that to me over and over and over again. I've done several shows with her and I don't think there's a single show where we didn't do well, right?
Yeah.
I worked on in Oblivion with her, and it was a point where like the budget was tight, everything was kind of crazy, and she came up to me because I was I was going to be the in charge of lighting for Oblivion, and she said, "All right, what can we do for our staffing to make sure you have everything you need, you'll be perfectly happy, and keep it as lean as possible?" And I said, "All right. Basically this is what I answer. It's like, I need, and this is a risky thing, by the way, I need a small staff of people that I've worked with very closely that are not cheap, right? I need people that are like some of the best in the business that I'm going to become 100% reliable." Now, she said, okay. And so I said, this is it. So basically we cut the lighting staff down to like a half or a third.
Yeah.
As long as they were really, really, really good. Now the risk there, and this has happened, it's bit me in the butt before. The risk there is that if anyone gets sick, that's like a big problem, or someone has a life crisis, that's a big problem. I worked on a show before where I did the same thing, and you know, I had a staff of about five because it was a smaller commercial, and three of them had major problems, like life crisis. And so that basically cut it down to me and two other people, and the other one sporadically there. And that's just draining, right? So if I had a lot of people, that's easier. But the fact is, as a supervisor, I know I'm lazy, right? As a supervisor, I don't want to, if you have a lot of junior people, you're spending a lot of time with all those people and dealing with all that stuff. And it's like, ugh. It's like, I need 25 lighters that really don't know anything. And then it's really tough on that. So keeping it to senior staff to make their budget work sort of helped. Now, to counter that, Eric Barba told me, he's like, yeah, all right, so you got your guys, right? And those are good guys. But you got to replace those guys because eventually those guys are going to become you. So you have to find a way to get good talent out there. So he put me on a mission. It was actually on Oblivion out there. It's like, go on a mission to find the next intern, right? The next guys. You always got to replenish it with junior people that are really cool as well. So that was an interesting lesson to me to learn as a supervisor, like, get your senior guys, but always compliment it with the junior guy because, you know, and I had a really amazing junior guy on Oblivion who was unbelievably talented and he didn't know it, which was great, but also really enthusiastic. And then he ended up doing all these cockpit shots, like, because that need to get done, right? Yeah. I got hundreds of cockpit shots that need to get done. And my senior guys are busy doing the big explosions and the big battlefield stuff. It's like, let's stick this guy on this stuff. And what he's going to learn is the pipeline and everything else, which he loved to do as well. And some junior guys don't love to do that because there's a lot of millennials out there that are like, why am I not getting the big shot? You know, but he wasn't that guy. He was a really cool person. So I learned a lot. I think there's a lot of balance that can be done in there. So it's cool.
One thing I like about what you said is I don't think that there's enough people bringing each other up in a mentorship thing anymore. I think they just sort of expect you to be senior and just sort of know everything. And I think that if you're talented and you work hard and you're more junior, that you should be find a way to be brought into the fold. And I just don't see that happening, especially in LA.
So
anymore.
You don't think mentorship is happening that much anymore, right? Because right now you're just, well, most work in LA is mostly freelancy, right now?
Yes,
right?
Yeah. That's
so true. You're like, everyone's a gun for hire, right?
Exactly.
Because most people are coming in and they've got like 14 years experience like you or whatever. And like, all right, we're just going to hire that person. Go ahead and do that shot. And so there's no opportunities for mentorship in this area.
Yeah. And I think it's unfortunate because I was brought up in a mentorship capacity, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel sorry for the poor souls who had to train me. But first company I was at, you know, I was like painting and, you know, learning until 4 o'clock in the morning and, you know, and then working all day on, you know, just sort of measly tasks. But that's how you learn and that's how you grow. And if you really have that drive to work that hard, then, you know, you should be given your chance.
Yeah, it's true. Mentorship was so important to me at an early part. I was always looking for the next mentor. I was always like, who do I want to be? Who wants to inspire me? And I don't know if people have that as much. But maybe I don't know.
I've seen a few places that do it, probably. Well, I don't know if I should name drop it all, but I think MPC LA trains up people. That's one of the best ones I've seen.
Really?
Yeah, they do actually bring in junior people and train them up. And I recommend them if I was going to be an intern again.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. People should know that. I mean, that, you know, they're pretty cool. Are they still in Santa Monica?
They're still in Santa Monica, yeah.
Up on 4th Street, right?
Yeah, I think it's 4th and Santa Monica, yeah.
Right, yeah. I thought they were going to move, but I don't know exactly. But they're really great guys. Nice guys over there. I like the NPC guys.
Yeah, they've done some really good work. I had a really good time on a few projects with them. I got to work with on a Godzilla spot with it was a car commercial, but we actually the Fiat car commercial, exactly. Yeah. And I got to use, we were using the actual Godzilla that was actually in the film.
Yeah.
And so that was really
fun. Was that with Andy Boyd?
Yep, that was Andy Boyd, yeah.
See? Small industry.
It is a small industry, yeah. Yeah, he's a really cool dude.
Yeah, South African, which...
he lives right around the corner from me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, okay, so you bought a house in Topanga.
I did, yes.
When did you move there?
I moved there last July, although I was in San Francisco working on Jurassic World for a bunch of it, so I wasn't actually in my own home for a while. But, yeah, it's beautiful up there. I love Topanga.
Yeah. It's what's amazing about Topanga, for the people who don't know much about Los Angeles, it's basically in the Santa Monica Mountains, which you live in, and it's this mountain that sort of separates the Pacific Ocean and the San Fernando Valley, right? So yeah. It's this big mountain that separates these things, and you drive through this mountain and you arrive in this small mountain town, in a sense. Although you're technically in Los Angeles, it feels like you're somewhat in like Switzerland in some weird way, you know, like some weird mountain town in the middle of Los Angeles. And it feels very remote in a lot of ways, right?
And for me, it's, to be honest, what keeps me sane most of the time, because right. I feel like I can leave the city and go into my little nest, and it feels really like I see nature. I'm 10 minutes from, you know, some of the best hiking in LA. And
we recently bought a house as well. Thank you. In Burbank, and we're right up against the Verdugo Mountains as well.
Oh, beautiful! Yeah, so Burbank is beautiful.
So I'm right there. So I've started, part of my New Year's resolution is start running again. I used to be a big runner, and it's like, you know what? Yeah. After whatever, I'm going to start running again. So woke up in the morning and decided, all right. 6 a.m., get my clothes on, I'm going to do, and it's, I used to run 100 miles a week. That's how much I used to run.
That's incredible.
That's back in college when I was running competitively, right? But now I'm like, all right, I gave myself a goal. If I do every other day, if I run 2 miles, that's going to be, make me feel better. So I get up, it's like 6 a.m., which is hard. But I'm like, all right, and the sun is just starting to rise, and I'm walking, running down my street. Jeez, there's like 3 coyotes right in front of my house.
Yes.
Yep.
Nature exists.
And I was like, oh crap, there's coyotes right there. And they're like, you know, they're wild dogs and they're can be dangerous. And so I'm like, oh, kind of freaking out because I've seen them in my neighborhood, but like mostly when I'm in a car or like in my house, when I see them walking down the street and I wake up early in the morning, it's like, oh, that's, but I was like, no, they're right there. And here I am in my running clothes in the mountains. And then I'm like kind of freaking out, like trying to stomp my feet. And I kind of like, okay, there's a person there. They kind of wander off a little bit. And so I'm like, all right, I'm just going to keep running. And this is a little bit strange and I'm a little bit scared. And then I see other runners just like running right by them in the opposite direction. Like no one gives a crap. I realize like, oh, I guess people know that they're not going to bother you and they're just like fine with it. But
Yeah, no, actually, we have a hot tub out our back deck that overlooks the sunset, and I feel very blessed for that. It's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
And one night we were sitting looking at the stars, sitting and chilling in the hot tub, and all these raccoons started coming up. Oh. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
I grabbed a rock and I was like, okay, if they get too close, and they were probably from here to the wall over there before they turned around and started going the other way. And I felt, wow, I am in nature now.
Yeah. It was funny. I'll tell a little side story. Back when my wife and I were starting to date, and this is back in Texas, and we were camping out in this island called Matagorda Island, which is kind of like a barrier island, similar to Galveston Island, but it's the whole island is a wildlife refuge, so it's kind of much more remote. We're camping out there. And I was explaining, I don't know if it was my wife or with someone else, but I was explaining that there's a huge amount of raccoons out there. And so therefore, when we go to bed, we got to make sure all of the food is put away. And it's like, really? It's like, yeah. It's like, there's a lot of raccoons. I mean, it's like, you have no idea. This is what they do. And I said, okay. And I said, they're all here. You just don't see them. And it's like, you know, it's like, they're all here. It's like, yeah. And I was like, oh, you want to see? And so we were sitting around the campfire or whatever. And I grabbed the flashlight and I just shined it in the darkness. And there was about 30 sets of eyes looking at us.
Yeah. It's intimidating when that happens, isn't
they're
it?
They're all just sitting there. Okay. One of these, you know, humans are going to go to sleep so that we can get to their food. They're all just waiting for us. And they're like all at the horizon. It's like, oh my God. And the person just freaked out. It's like, don't worry about it.
They're fine.
They're fine. They're not going to bother you. They're just waiting for you to go to sleep. And then they will or will not get to the food, you know, depending on what we do to it. Yeah. Raccoons are crazy. They're amazing little animals, those raccoons. Yeah.
Yeah. Has your son seen them?
He has not seen the raccoons yet. He's seen the coyotes. We apparently have bobcats in our neighborhood. We haven't seen those yet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
We have the Verdugo Mountains, which is a small chain of island of mountains kind of right in our backyard, has a mountain lion in it. Mountain lions need a large range per mountain lion, so there's usually much more less distribution. But there's one mountain lion, apparently he's tagged, and his name is P-41, so everyone knows P-41. P-41 is protected in a lot of ways, but apparently one of our neighbors is a few blocks away. He jumped in their backyard, grabbed their poodle, and went away.
Yeah, little dogs in the canyons aren't the best idea.
No. Or do not go outside, right? Or if you have cats.
Yeah, exactly. Or they're indoors.
Yeah.
Yeah, I keep my cats indoors. And actually, the boy cat is really intent on wanting to go outside. Mm-hmm. And I just love him enough to keep him inside.
Yeah. My mother lives, by the way, the coyote problem in the United States is huge because my mother lives in Connecticut and there's coyotes everywhere, right? And she's lost 2 or 3 cats to coyotes, right? So
yeah,
it's a problem. So anyway, it's interesting, the whole nature thing. We talked a lot about nature today. This is kind of cool because I want to cover a bunch of things. But well, we're actually at already about an hour, but I really want to thank you about talking about compositing. I think people are really interested in that field. What would you say if someone wants to understand more about compositing, or what would you say is some of the best learning tools they can do out there to learn about compositing or be involved in that?
You know, it just takes a lot of discipline, to be honest. But I think if you want it bad enough and you keep your eye on the prize, then you can learn, and then just find any time you can find layers, try and put them together, and then ask someone who you can trust who, you know, did I do this right? What would you recommend? And, you know, just try and find as many mentors as you can. And that's what I would recommend, because, you know, it takes... You know, there's kind of an art to it, and everyone has their own way of doing things.
Right.
But, you know, I think you ask, you know, like, do everything you can, read the manual, and then from there, you know, try and get a mentor.
I think that one of the things that was the hardest thing when I started learning Nuke is that node-based compositing or node-based anything was hard to transition from, right? Because you're so ingrained in the linear layer concept of Photoshop, right? But the difference between Photoshop and Nuke is not dissimilar. It's just that the way that it's represented is different. But the way in Nuke is actually like opens you up to understanding it in a two-dimensional way instead of three-dimensional. And I think that's the hard transition. But once you understand that, 2 + 2 = 4, no matter how you stack it, it still works, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I know, well, I shouldn't admit this because I don't really want to take any After Effects jobs, but I do know After Effects. And,
sure.
And, you know, I got used very early on, and I actually used to love Combustion. That was like my program. I'm so gutted that it's not really being used anymore in production. But, you know, just...
That's Baby Flame, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and the tracker was just, there's some things about that program that I miss still to this
day.
Yeah, absolutely. I was trying to track something in Nuke, and I was like, I'm sorry, you guys. I love Nuke to bits, but you guys need to work on that tracker.
Really? You think the Combustion tracker from way back when was better than Nuke?
Was better than Nuke's tracker, yes.
Wow, that says something.
I'm so sorry to anyone Foundry. I've offended, but... Absolutely.
You know, there's a lot of founding people actually.
You could hit the track button in Combustion, walk away, and come back and have a perfect track without thinking
funny.
Twice.
There's a lot of founding people actually listen to this podcast, so we're putting it out there to you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm throwing down the
all right.
gauntlet. So, but I think that when you know After Effects and you think of it as these layers, and then the top layer is the one you see, Nuke isn't that different in Nodal, in that you just, whatever's next to the read node, that's the next layer. And
right.
so you can sort of see it as a layered, you know, in your mind, you can actually visualize that as being
right.
layers, actually. But it's just, it's easier to view and manipulate than it is in After Effects.
Yeah. What's funny is that when I learned Nuke, it was back at DD before it was a commercial product, right?
Yeah, me too.
Right. And so when you'd open Nuke, it was just a blank slate. There was no real interface to it at all. It was like, here's your slate. Just start dropping nodes and figure it out. And I'm like, oh, I don't even know what I'm doing. Because especially if you never – there's no timeline. There's nothing. And until you open an actual frame buffer, there's no – like it was so confusing to me to understand that. But then I was like, oh, I totally get it. So now when I open Nuke, it's got all these panels and stuff. And I was like, oh, no, I actually shut it all down and I turn it back to a blank slate because I actually like it as a blank slate better than other players. So, I'd love to have a setting in Nuke where it's just like blank. Just give me the blank slate where I can do that. And I actually do that. That's the first thing I do when I open Nuke is like just turn off all of these other panels. I don't want it to look like Shake because that's basically what it does. It makes it look like Shake. And it's like, no, it's not Shake. And just give me the blank slate.
Yeah, I use the tab a lot.
And, oh, the tab. Yeah,
the tab. Yeah, I mean, that's like the most brilliant thing they have.
For people who don't know, it's like if you use Nuke and you're basically sitting there and you're trying to find a node, let's say you say, I need a multiply node or I need an operation that does this. All you do in Nuke is you hit tab. And then you start typing name of the node, as long as you know what it is, and it'll come up just like a search box, right? And then suddenly like, nope, boom. And then you basically, nothing is there because you already know what you need. And it's like tab, I need multiply, boom, there it is, clack, and it adds it. So it just makes it really, really easy, which is awesome.
Yeah, Nuke is an incredibly powerful tool.
I'm starting to learn Houdini for some weird reason. I don't know. Houdini has the same thing. So I want to say, Houdini, thank you for making tab available the same way that Nuke works. I really appreciate that. It's made it easier for me too.
I know maybe they can add a Houdini plugin for Nuke one day because I know they added it for Maya, didn't they? Added a Houdini,
the Houdini
plugin
engine,
for,
right? Houdini engine. Yeah.
I know. I'm like, come on, man. You got to add that to Nuke.
We should, there's a V-Ray for Nuke, right?
I know. No production houses have V-Ray.
Not true. There's a couple of them that do.
I'm desperate to get houses to use it because I would. There's so many times when I'm trying to fix something in 3D and I'm like, oh, wait, the scanline renderer can't handle it.
Right.
I'm like, well, it's
let me
such
know.
A powerful
I can,
tool.
I can, let me know if there's a situation or a place that's like, hey, I know the guy who can make this happen. I can do that. And But
I know people who know people
now. Yeah, yeah. No, because V-Ray for Nuke, I think, is a really powerful tool. And I think it's that thing is like, hey, what's interesting from the people who have used V-Ray for Nuke is that because it's a compositing program, the problems that they're solving are so unusual because compositors always think in these weird ways, right? They think differently. So like, oh, there's a guy, Shaheen, who was talking to us, and when he was using V-Ray for Nuke, he used V-Ray to simulate green spill on a character to use that to subtract the actual green spill off the person and got a better green spill removal based on simulating the actual green light.
Wow.
Than actually
incredible.
Trying to remove the green out of it. Because like, oh, I know where the green is supposed to be based on the ray tracing. So therefore now I can remove it. And it's like you used a ray tracer for green spill removal.
that's very interesting.
Yeah. So you can find some interesting things to do that way. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. The other day I was doing a phone spot and I was trying to get some fake sheen on the phone and we were just having trouble doing it in 3D and I was trying to get a sheen and it was just really impossible.
Right.
Even if I added the light in the scanline renderer couldn't really give me the kind of nice sheen. And
yeah,
I was like,
easily done that with V-Ray.
Yeah, I was going to say if I'd had the V-Ray plug, I would have been able to add it in 2 seconds flat. And I was like,
And then you don't have to go to a 3D guy and say, can you, I'm going to give you an element and can you try to
track it and put it in there and get me a sheet. And like, it's a lot of steps, right? And you gotta wait for it. So if you just can do it, it'd be great. Yeah.
I mean, that's one thing that's really cool about compositing is you can save so much money and so much time and so much frustration. I mean, yep. I've completely relit characters, very complicated characters, mm-hmm. That were accidentally lit the wrong way, but they had all this complicated fur and, you know, it would have taken out, you know, so much yep. render farm time. And, you know, I've completely relit it using yep. a few tools like the normals pass.
The normals, you know, yeah. Normals tell you where the light should come through and you can just add more light in that direction.
Yeah, right? Between that and, well, they call it different stuff at different places, but like the reference position pass, mm-hmm. you know, you between those two passes, you can pretty much relight almost anything.
Yeah.
And I've been doing a lot of car stuff lately and like, you know, if the car isn't lit quite right, they don't have the time to re-render yep. it and I can completely relight the vehicle the way I need
yeah.
to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's, yeah, I know that. I used to do a lot of car commercials, but yeah, and that's good. But the fact is that the only way that's going to happen, and it's not to say that is as long as the compositor understands how to light something correctly, and I'm going to tie it back to the beginning of the podcast, and the best compositors I know how to relight things in compositing are people who actually have a photography background. Because yes. if you understand photography, you understand how it works, which basically puts you in a position of what a lighter does. A lighter is pretty much a photographer in a lot of ways, right? They're like, oh yeah, here's the lights and do that. And the rendering is the result of the photography. So I think the compositors that work really well, like the Kurt Larsons and who are like know what it's like to be behind the camera. Those are the guys who really understand how to put those elements together. And I think that's great. And so I think that's probably another good reason why you're probably been a very successful compositor for so many years. So.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Well, that's been cool. So we've had a lot of great discussions here. I really appreciate it. It's gone perfect length for my podcast, which is always a little long, but I appreciate it. So I'd love to be able to, if anything else happens in terms of especially on your VR projects, I'd love to learn more about that. Let us know. Come back. Let us know what we can do to work with you or for anything else that's going on. And then I'm going to, once I turn the mics up, I want to show you some cool stuff we've done in VR so you can get, you know, figure out some of the cool things that we're doing on our lab side as well, because it's pretty interesting as well.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Well, thanks.